I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Where will the leadership come from to innovate successful futures for America's cities? Paul Grogan is testing some new and exciting possibilities in his hometown of Boston, where he runs the Community Foundation. And what he's learning has application for cities everywhere. We'll talk with Paul Grogan today on Smart City. Also with us is Joe Courtwright, who has just completed a new study for CEOs for cities called The Young and Restless in a Knowledge Economy. He spotted a couple of trends that urban leaders better pay attention to. Joe Courtwright and Paul Grogan are our guests today on Smart City, right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Paul Grogan is president and CEO of the Boston Foundation. He came to the foundation from Harvard University, where he was vice president of government, community, and public affairs. Paul served for 12 years as president and CEO of the nonprofit Local Initiative Support Corporation, or LISC, where he raised and invested more than $3 billion of private capital in inner-city revitalization, resulting in 80,000 homes for low-income families and nearly 13 million square feet of commercial and community facilities. Paul worked in the administrations of Boston Mayors Kevin White and Ray Flynn, pioneering a series of public-private ventures that included the much-copied Boston Compact. Paul is founder of CEOs for Cities and author of Comeback Cities, a Blueprint for Urban Neighborhood Revival. Paul, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Good to be with you, Carol.
In 2000, you wrote a book, Comeback Cities, which made you one of the first observers to note the trend that cities indeed were coming back. What did you see then that others didn't?
Well, you know, we'd been through such a long urban crisis where the American people and our leadership had gotten so used to thinking of cities as in decline that they were really failing to notice a lot of signs of improvement in America's cities, and I'm someone who has been on the ground working on urban revitalization for a long time. It was very frustrating that the national conversation about cities continued to be so glum, frankly. Comeback Cities was an attempt to put in front of the leadership and the public a very, very different view that certainly talked about the renaissance of downtowns across the country and a new taste for urban living that was showing itself in many places. Cities that had been losing enormous numbers of people since shortly after World War II had stabilized. Many of them were gaining population again. So there was new life vitality, the cultural attractions, the diversity, the restaurants, the nightlife of cities were clearly showing themselves again. But even more important than that, because of the degree of difficulty and the degree of pessimism, urban neighborhoods, even very low-income neighborhoods, were also showing new signs of life. A very important grassroots community development movement had grown up in the country. There were thousands of so-called community development corporations that had been formed by the residents of low-income communities that had done really heroic work in rescuing many neighborhoods that had really been in ruins. Markets were starting to return to cities. You see new life in commercial districts, in major supermarkets in many cases, returning to urban environments that they had left 15 or 20 years before. So there's this process of reintegrating these very isolated urban communities into the mainstream market. Cities had become synonymous with out-of-control crime during the bad old days. Well, guess what? New York, Boston, and then many other cities showed that a remarkable drops in crime could be engineered, and cities were becoming much safer again. So there were a whole host of trends that we called a surprising convergence of positives in our book, Comeback Cities, which, again, were kind of implausible based on the view we all had that cities were headed for the dustbin of history. But it was certainly great news for our civilization that so many cities came back and started to show that, particularly in the 90s.
And Paul, 6 years later, what do you see now for cities? Are cities still coming back?
Well, many are. One of the great drivers of urban revitalization is waterfront development. Of course, many of our cities are on either oceans or rivers or great lakes. During the industrial period, most urban waterfronts were not places that people who didn't work there went. But there is this great process of recycling formerly industrial waterfronts into mixed-use, residential, commercial, recreational. There's this great coming back to the water. I call it the new form of water power in urban development. So you see that happening. The progress in crime has gotten a little shaky in some places, but is holding steady in others. I think urban downtowns are continuing to display a lot of vitality and a lot of life. And they're getting a burst of energy from two demographic sources. One is the aging baby boomer population, many of whom raised their children in the suburbs. Those children are now grown up and gone off to college, and these folks are saying, why are we staying in this big house in the suburbs that we don't need anymore? The city is so exciting. Why don't we go down there so we're close to the restaurants and the cultural attractions that we like so much? And so cities that have remade their downtowns into lively urban districts like Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, and many others now are enjoying a downtown living boom, which is boosting the population, bringing people of means into the downtown who represent life on the street, people who will vote, who will insist on safety and good services, people who will patronize the restaurants, contribute to the cultural institutions. So this is an enormous boost that, given the size and length of the baby boom cohort, will really go on for some time if cities can keep their act together. And of course, we continue to live through one of the great periods of immigration in American history. And immigrants do not spread themselves evenly among American cities. There are some American cities that have attracted very few immigrants, but others that have become major ports of call. And that's been another source of great vitality for cities, and particularly important in regions of the country that are not growing otherwise, like the one I'm in. Boston and Massachusetts really has an out-migration problem, but we have benefited from a big influx of immigrants, and many of those immigrants, at least initially, come into the cities. So I think that there is still lots and lots of progress. On the other hand, we continue to see the great wealth and income disparities in our society reflected very, very dramatically in the cities. Poverty is on the rise. The middle class is getting a little bit hollowed out in America, and this is a particularly pronounced trend in cities. And finally, I would say, on the negative side, we really have failed to move quickly enough to improve urban public education. It is an area of great ferment and change. It is true, dramatic things are starting to happen in places like Chicago, Philadelphia, and New York because of the impatience with the poor performance of our urban public school systems. But we still have a long way to go, and the poor quality of the schools and the apprehension about that continues to drive upwardly mobile families out of the city when their children reach school age. And we're just not moving fast enough on that issue.
You and I have talked about the disappearance of corporate leaders in the local civic landscape. You've experienced that in Boston because many of your top corporate leaders have found themselves merged or globalized. What has been the response in Boston? How have you replaced those corporate leaders?
You're quite right. It's been a very interesting process of corporate consolidation that is going on everywhere as a process of globalization, and so that very few cities anymore can define themselves by the constellation of headquarters companies. It kind of gave that community a certain identity. And here in Boston, we've lost the Bank of Boston to Fleet and now Bank of America. John Hancock, a household name company, has disappeared, and Gillette has been acquired by Procter & Gamble, all in the space of a little more than a year. So it's really gotten a conversation going here. I think most smart people believe that the economy will not necessarily suffer because of consolidation if a region or a city remains healthy in other respects. But there's definitely an impact on what I call the civic realm and on corporate philanthropy, because these large corporations used to be the ones whose CEOs were very involved in civic life, who would define, at least as part of their job, supplying private initiative and private support for important civic ventures, and also giving generously through their corporate philanthropic programs. And so it's really this area that has left Boston, and I think many other cities, wondering where civic leadership is going to come from. And what that means, I believe, because private initiative will continue to be so important to urban progress, is that we have to reinvent the civic realm. We have to look to new places for leadership. An obvious place in Boston is our remarkable set of institutions of higher education and healthcare. They are really the dominant employers at this point. Mass General Hospital, Harvard, Tufts, Boston Boston University, Beth Israel Hospital. These are the intertwined research universities and teaching hospitals that are so important to the economy. They're enormous industries in and of themselves, and they're here. They will not be moving, in all likelihood, to other locales. So it's really, they can supply more of the definition. And I think the leaders of those institutions, who in most cases are extremely talented individuals, must redefine their roles somewhat so that they are less insular than they were in the past and participating more in civic life. There are also people in the investment firms, in the law firms, that aren't as visible as the big old corporations used to be, who need to find a way to get involved. And if cities do not invent mechanisms for new forms of civic leadership to emerge, I think it's going to be a very serious problem indeed.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Paul Grogan. He's president of the Boston Foundation. But the president of a university or a hospital is fundamentally different than a president of a for-profit corporation because, on the one hand, he or she may be able to provide civic leadership, but typically can't hand out a check. Because, in fact, they are seeking checks. They're not donors. They're recipients. So what could that new structure look like that uses those prospective community leaders in the right way?
Money is, of course, important, and you're quite right. That's one key difference, is that universities and hospitals are unlikely to make anything more than very modest charitable contributions. And unless you're Harvard, you're really not able to do so. But on the other hand, their influence could be considerable, and a big part of civic leadership is influence, providing disinterested leadership to the major issues and challenges of the day so that our elected and political leaders can really see the true choices available to them. So creating mechanisms for providing that kind of leadership is important. I don't think there'll be any shortage of philanthropic capital in a city like Boston. If you look at the projections for the great transfers of wealth that are underway, the tax incentives that remain in our system for charitable giving. For instance, the assets in Massachusetts private foundations have more than doubled since 1998, from about $4 billion to over $9 billion. But that philanthropy will be in different places. It'll be in private foundations. It'll be in very wealthy individuals and families. And part of the job of reinventing the civic realm is enticing those folks and penetrating the networks of people like that so that they are invited in, not just to write checks to their favorite charities, but to participate in a broader way. And I'm not saying this is going to be easy, and there's a good deal of uncertainty associated with it. But there's also some excitement because, let's face it, not everyone thought that having the white guys in suits representing the big businesses should be in charge of private initiative. There were some downsides to that. Now we have an opportunity to have a much more open, inclusive, and dynamic civic process if we can figure out how to organize it properly and bring the necessary force to the priorities that we have as a community. But I think the openness and fluidity and dynamism that is there and the room for others to take their place at the table is really very exciting and renewing, and we have to take advantage of it.
You've tried to use the Boston Foundation as one of those mechanisms. Tell me how you've stepped up the foundation's role.
Well, the Boston Foundation is a community foundation, and just about every major community in the United States has one. In most cases, these are highly respected institutions that do have resources, that are significant grant makers, and can really offer themselves in a different way to the community. And that's what the board of the Boston Foundation very much wanted to do. Seeing this vacuum of civic leadership unfolding, they asked the question, why couldn't this venerable charity, whose mission, after all, is to improve the community, go beyond grant-making to offer itself as a kind of civic leader? And so we've really changed our role very considerably. We still make a lot of grants to superb nonprofit organizations across a broad range of issues, but we also commission a great deal of research on local and regional issues. We hold a very large number of civic conversations, seminars, conferences, workshops of all kinds to bring people together to consider what's happening in our region. And where we see an opportunity, we have catalyzed action groups, impromptu coalitions that have agreed to work on an issue together. And we've had some real success with that in the last couple of years, including getting major legislation through the state legislature in Massachusetts on affordable housing, another piece on arts and culture, and yet another on workforce. demonstrating, I think, that the principle has to be disinterested leadership and creating mechanisms for disinterested leadership to come to the forum for work together on an issue and exercise the influence in behalf of the community that they have. We also have something called the Boston Indicators Project, and civic indicators projects are kind of a trend in urban America, but we were one of the first to start one, and this is a giant continuing research effort that is collecting and synthesizing vast amounts of data on what is happening in the city of Boston and the Boston region, and putting that data out in highly accessible ways, both on the web and in periodic hard copy reports, as a way to keep ourselves in touch with the key trends. And it is permitting us to have a very intelligent conversation about what's happening in the city and prompting us, I think, to be able to develop consensus more quickly on where we have to act. So this is just one illustration of how a philanthropic institution, in this case, changed its role in response to these changing dynamics in cities, realizing that private and civic initiative is every bit as important as good political leadership, which is also essential in solving the problems we have.
You've raised two questions. One, explain what you mean by disinterested leadership.
Of course, most public policy questions are a contest of interests. There are interests, whether it's healthcare or the environment or education or anything else, there are interest groups that have a direct stake in the outcome of a particular policy or piece of legislation. Disinterested leaders are those outside of that immediate circle of interest who have a broader view, perhaps a higher view of what is at stake. And the involvement of disinterested leaders can change the choices, and I would say improve the choices that are available to public leaders. So if it's just the interest groups who have the most at stake, you know, you're not going to get very good public policy made from that. But if you can organize the community influential people who can say, you know, I'm not going to benefit directly one way or another from this outcome, but here's what I think is at stake for the community, that really changes the equation pretty dramatically. A lot of the progress we've made in this city and Boston has enjoyed a tremendous renaissance in the second half of the 20th and going into the 21st century, has been because of the involvement of disinterested leaders who were able to change the equation, get a better choice made, and carry the city forward.
You also raised the question, what should be the relationship, Paul, between elected leaders and civic leaders?
I believe that they need each other very, very badly for reasons that I've outlined. Political leaders often are very, very constrained in what they can do because of the direct pressures that are on them. But very different choices can emerge if they get help and cover and good information and support from civic leaders. And so that's a vital function. You also, frankly, don't want your political leaders left to themselves to decide everything. And one of the consequences of the decline of business leadership in cities could be that the political leaders get much more powerful. I don't think that's a good thing, and I don't think that will result in better government. So there's a symbiosis, I think, and smart politicians love to have active civic organizations to work with. They can be punishing at times, they can be sources of criticism, but they can also be sources of strength and support. And as I said, almost manufacturing better choices. There's a great example from education reform here in the state of Massachusetts, which has gotten a lot of attention for the at least relatively superior performance of our public schools in recent years. And it stems from an education reform bill that was passed in 1993 that established a statewide testing system to make sure that our young people were moving along with the required levels of knowledge. This was bitterly resisted by all of the organized interests in public education. If it were left to them, it never would have happened. But because of the involvement in this case, a vigorous continuing involvement of business leaders who were very worried about the skills or lack of skills that high school graduates were coming out of Massachusetts high schools with, really prevailed and enabled Democratic politicians, normally very responsive to public education interests, to make a fundamentally different choice, and I would argue a better choice. Well, we have to do that again and again and again.
What are the issues cities face that you think are ripe for innovative new approaches? Many times the concern seems to be we need more money, it's underfunded. But sometimes what's really needed is a brand new idea. Where do you think those opportunities lie, Paul?
Well, I think they lie in a number of areas. We certainly have to make sure that cities have a talent pool. And that's particularly important in a place like Boston, which is a knowledge technology-based economy. We will live or die based on the level of talent that we have. So obviously that means renewed and I would say more radical efforts to improve public education. But we also have to establish a workforce system that really works and that's employer-driven. And we have labor shortages in Boston and Massachusetts, and that creates incentives for employers to partner with nonprofit organizations to develop innovative workforce programs. And we have not been good at this in the United States. We don't have a system, really, of workforce development that enables high school graduates to progress into families supporting jobs at scale. So that's an urgent task where we really need to build that system. Using our community colleges, nonprofit training organizations, and so forth. I think arts and culture is another area where we really need to recognize how vital and crucial that is for the life of our cities, including the economic life of our cities. We've gotten into this habit of thinking of arts and culture as a frill, as an extra, when it is really sort of fundamental to what cities offer to the civilization, but also to the economies of the cities, their role in attracting dynamic and talented young people, which is getting recognition as such an important factor in the health of cities. So I think we really need to look at the new city with a new lens and think differently about some of these issues. But happily, we're building on some great progress of the last 20 years, as opposed to confronting the situation we did in the 60s and the 70s of more and more cities in ruins and just tremendous pessimism about our ability to bring them back.
You mentioned workforce, and that's an area that I would love to have all the money we've thrown away in so-called workforce development. Do you see any models you like?
Well, we have a program that has been developed here in Boston called SkillWorks, and the fundamental change from the programs that you and I agree were a tremendous waste of money over many decades is that SkillWorks is employer-driven. We're not funding any program that doesn't have deep systemic employer involvement. And they may elect to partner with nonprofits, and that's terrific. But the old idea of putting out a request for proposals to nonprofit training organizations and hoping that they could enlist employers in their training efforts, we've got to dispense with that. We don't have the time or money to fool around with that anymore. The good news is, as I mentioned, that many employers, and healthcare is a great example of that in terms of a big industry here in Boston, are newly incented to re-examine their human resources practices and to commit themselves to bringing people along, minorities, immigrants, people who are hungry to move up the economic ladder and with the proper training and internships and exposure can migrate fairly quickly to family-supporting jobs with benefits. I think that's one of the big opportunities that cities have and that America has. And overall, as you know, Carol, with the aging of the baby boom, we're going to go from decades of labor surpluses to acute labor shortages, not just in places like Boston, but across the country. And that really needs to be addressed. But if it is addressed, it will be a way to create an opportunity society, and we desperately need to reestablish the American dream as not just an idea but a reality that you, with hard work and determination, you can move up and succeed in America. And that idea is, you know, is being questioned more and more.
What are Paul Grogan's three rules for civic leaders?
Have great information and spend some time getting that information out and getting a common vocabulary established. Second, be willing to be persistent and tenacious and to stay with an issue over a considerable period of time. And always be talking to the people that you don't need to talk to outside of that initial circle to pull in more and more people, to be ambitious in enlisting people to help you. Widening that circle is very, very powerful. So I think those are the three rules that we hope are working for us here in Boston and allowing the Boston Foundation to drive some very important civic initiatives.
Paul, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City again.
Great to be with you, Carol. Thanks for having me.
Paul Grogan is president and CEO of the Boston Foundation. After a short break, we'll return to talk with Joe Courtwright about his new study for CEOs for cities on the importance of the young and restless to your city. And we'll talk to Otis White about the perception of security. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, why do people move to gated communities? In part, they move to gated communities because they think they will be safer. but you've discovered an item from the Orlando Sentinel which says maybe that's not the case.
Yeah, it surprised me. I'm sure it surprised a lot of folks to read this. The Orlando Sentinel did an enterprising bit of work. They looked at suburban crime statistics in the Orlando area, Central Florida area, over a four-year period, and they were trying to compare property crimes that take place in gated and ungated subdivisions. And what they found is that the crime rates in ungated subdivisions are usually as low as those in the gated areas. In fact, they came to the conclusion that what people are really buying when they're buying into a gated community is the perception of security and not the security itself. So how can this be? As you may know, to get into a gated community, you have to know a code. You go up the little keypad, you punch in the code, the gate swings open, and you come through and the gate closes. So how can that possibly not be more secure than the regular kind of neighborhood where you just drive in? Well, the answer seems to be everybody knows those codes. Somebody said every pizza guy, every work guy, you know, everybody who does any kind of delivery service knows those codes, and they get around. And in fact, sometimes when they have yard sales, they'll actually post the codes out there on the gate. Well, if you want to come in, punch in 4767, and you drive right in. So. So crooks may be bad people, but they're not necessarily stupid people, and they accumulate these numbers. They did find that there was some difference in crimes of opportunity. Vandalism tends to be a little less because it tends to be less premeditated. People don't plan those things. Sort of crime where somebody comes along and smashes the side of a window in a car and reaches in and grabs something, that tended to be a little bit less in the gated communities. But the big ones, the ones that you're really afraid about, that people will break into your house and steal things, or that they'll steal your car, those things were identical, gated and ungated.
This is amazing that all of the money that's been spent and all of the debate that's occurred around gated communities, only to find that the security is equal.
Yeah, it's an illusion. There is one little interesting footnote to this, Carol. The Orange County, which is where Orlando is located, has recently said it will not approve any more gated communities. It didn't have anything to do with the public safety issue of people stealing things. It had to do with a different public safety issue. Its work crews could not get into these neighborhoods after a hurricane to take out debris because they didn't know the codes. And so they just said, no more of this. When we have hurricane damage, it's too important that we be able to get in there for public safety reasons. The cops know the codes, but the work crews do not, and so we're not going to allow them anymore.
Sounds like the work crews were the only ones who didn't know the codes. We'll talk to you next week, Otis.
Okay, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Economist Joe Courtwright is always uncovering new insights about cities. His home base is Portland, Oregon, where he runs Impresa Consulting. His latest work is for CEOs for cities, and it's called The Young and Restless in a Knowledge Economy. Joe, who are the young and restless?
Well, the young and restless are the college-educated young adults, 25 to 34 years old.
And why are they important to cities?
Well, it's interesting when you look at 25 to 34-year-olds as a group, there are fewer of them today than there were a decade ago. And that's happening at just a time when U.S. labor markets are starting to undergo a major sea change. All the things that fueled the growth of the U.S. labor market over the last three or four decades are either coming to a halt or turning around. The baby boom generation is on the verge of retirement. Women's labor force participation, which really dramatically increased the size of the U.S. labor force over the last several decades, is now basically the same as men's and isn't going to increase anymore. And we're also seeing a real flattening out in the college graduation rate in the United States. You add all those things together, and we're headed for a period of much, much tighter labor markets in the U.S.
Now, it seems like the past month was declared, how do we keep baby boomers from retiring month? There was an endless number of stories in national newspapers and magazines on the topic. Will that solve the problem that you foresee of these looming labor shortages?
You know, it's one of those inexorable things. And while it's likely that baby boomers will retire in a different pattern than the generations that went before them, we know that as the years go by, they'll begin moving out of the labor force. And we're already seeing that in a number of occupations that have either a long tenure or which tend to burn out people earlier, things like nursing and construction and skilled manufacturing trades. They're already experiencing labor shortages as their boomers retire. I spoke to a utility company executive yesterday who told me that 80% of the people in her company who were in the technical positions were now retirement eligible. So it's a very real phenomenon, and it's something that we'll continue to see in the years ahead.
We've talked before on the show about the studies that we did in six American cities on college-educated 25 to 34-year-olds, the people you call the young and the restless. What did this recent national study for CEOs for cities tell you that the other studies did not?
Well, it shows that really the economic opportunities and the economic destiny of cities throughout the nation is greatly tied to their ability to attract and to retain these very talented young adults, both in terms of the labor force and in terms of the new entrepreneurial energy that will help drive city economies in the decades ahead. This group will play a very critical role.
Now, apart from the overall theme of the report, college-educated young people are in short supply to meet the coming labor shortages, and cities have to compete to attract and keep them, there were two findings in the study that really stand out for me. One is the importance of women. Give me the background on the rising importance of women.
Well, one of the interesting things about this generation, these people who are now 25 to 34-year-olds, is that for the first time in U.S. history, women in this age group are better educated than their male counterparts. And that change basically happened during the decade of the 1990s. And today, women in this age group are about 10% more likely to have completed a four-year degree than are men. So when we talk about the young and the restless, we're really talking, in the largest part, about women. And that's a change from historically how U.S. labor markets have worked.
The second finding that intrigues me is that young people are more likely than other Americans to live within a 3-mile radius of the central business district. Does that mean that cities with appealing in-town neighborhoods are more likely to appeal to young people?
Yeah, that's clearly one of the major findings of our work, is that especially compared to 20 and even 10 years ago, these young adults are much more likely than other Americans to choose to live in those close-in neighborhoods. One of the striking findings of our result was that ratio of relative preference by young adults for close-in living actually increased in every single one of the 50 largest metropolitan areas in the United States over the last decade.
Are young people the people who are driving this revitalization we're seeing in cities across the U.S.? I mean, is that what's happening?
Yeah, and it varies, obviously, from place to place, and different cities have different relative success in attracting talented young people to their centers. So it's really clear, though, that one of the things that distinguishes the cities that are doing the best is the fact that they're doing a really phenomenal job in attracting the well-educated young adults to their centers.
Joel Kotkin, an author and prolific writer, makes the case that college-educated young people are moving to less expensive third-tier cities. Do you see any evidence of that?
No, actually, we see, you know, pretty much the reverse. That, you know, first of all, we know that this group is overwhelmingly metropolitan in their focus. If you're a 25 to 34-year-old with a four-year degree, you're much, much more likely than the average American to live in one of the 50 largest metropolitan areas in the U.S., just to begin with. But then when you look at the metropolitan areas that have the largest concentrations of well-educated young adults, they tend to be the very largest cities and cities with vibrant urban cores. And then when you look at the center of those areas, when you look at the center of Manhattan or San Francisco or Chicago, you find that the highest concentration of well-educated young adults is really in those close-in neighborhoods.
Then why do newspapers keep running his op-ed pieces? It's very confusing.
Well, I think Joel has a very good way of being provocative and offering what, at least superficially, are plausible or intuitive arguments. But one of the things about smart young people is we know that they're not really driven by price considerations. They're not necessarily looking for the cheapest place to live. They're looking for places that offer opportunity, career opportunities, personal opportunities, social opportunities. And it's not the case that the cheap housing prices are particularly important to a large numbers of people in this age group.
Based on Richard Florida's writing and what I generally think are misinterpretations of his work, fueled by maybe some overenthusiastic consultants, some urban leaders are in pursuit, Joe, of cool communities as the way to attract young people. In your opinion, is that the correct goal?
No, I think there's no one definition of cool. I think it really has to do more with, do you have a distinctive, vibrant community? And that's going to mean different things in different places. I don't think there's any one recipe for success or one recipe for attracting this group of people. I mean, if we're talking about college-educated 25 to 34-year-olds, you're talking about 10, 11 million people in the United States, and they obviously don't all share the same tastes and preferences. So different cities should logically be pursuing different paths to attract the set of people who will find their community most attractive.
I know you've done a lot of work in this area of distinctiveness and thought a lot about what it means to cities and how it makes cities more valuable. Talk a little bit about distinctiveness and perhaps a corollary, authenticity, and what that means to cities.
If you think about cities in economic terms, one of the paradoxes is, you know, cities tend to be more expensive places to live than, say, rural communities. So what is it that attracts people to live there? And it really has to do with the set of opportunities that cities provide. They provide a different set of consumption opportunities, whether it's theaters or restaurants or clubs. They also provide different sets of public goods, parks and museums and so on, and social opportunities, a more diverse population in many cases. So that's the sort of thing that can make cities distinctive. And every city really offers a different mix of those things. And I think understanding what your mix of things is and who you appeal to is really an important component of building a distinctive community that's also economically vibrant.
In thinking about understanding your own distinctiveness, what's the interplay, Joe, of the market and what the market wants? I mean, you've been studying the young and restless, for instance, college-educated 25 to 34-year-olds, and you make the point, rightly so, that they all do not want the same thing, and to treat them as monolithic is ignorant. But on the other hand, in other words, I am what I am as a city. I have a distinctive set of characteristics, and I have a distinctive history, et cetera. And then there's the market and what the market wants. What's the interplay of those two things? How does a city take its distinctiveness and at the same time respond to the market demand?
It's not necessarily a question of responding to the market demand. It's often about creating or changing the market demand. And the interesting thing, I think if you think about cities, and this is an argument Jane Jacobs has made for decades now, and I think she's clearly right, is that cities are places where people develop new ideas and new ways of thinking, and then that changes the marketplace. And I think if you look seriously at any of the ideas, they've really emerged from cities, and I think that's the way to think about this connection between markets and distinctiveness is, can your distinctiveness help your city to become a place that generates the new ideas that fuel your business community, that make your community a more interesting and vibrant place to live, and which over time really contribute to economic growth?
I want to ask you a different question, Joe. We often see published conflicting information about what's happening in cities. We read a lot of good news about downtowns around the country, and we see it with all the cranes. But then we also read that jobs and people are leaving cities. Explain what's really happening based on the facts rather than on anecdotes.
Well, that's a tall order. You know, I think that there really are some signs of a pretty strong urban renaissance in many places. This tendency of young people to want to choose to live in close-in neighborhoods relative to other Americans is one of those trends. But this is one of those cases where, as an economist, the devil is really in the details. And it really comes down to accurately measuring what's going on in the ground in different neighborhoods. So I'd love to give you, Carol, the definitive answer to that question. But the occupational handicap I have is that, you know, until I've looked at all the data, it's difficult to give an answer. And it's one of those things that we know will vary from a lot from place to place. There isn't one sweeping generalization one can make about how this is transpiring.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Joe Courtwright, author of the new report from CEOs for Cities, The Young and Restless, an Analogy Economy and Principle with Impresa Consulting in Portland, Oregon. You've been working, Joe, with a group of business leaders in Oregon to develop a statewide plan for economic development. Explain your basic approach to economic development.
The Oregon Business Plan, it's now in its fourth year, has been an effort led by private sector business leaders in cooperation with a wide variety of public leaders, the governor, our congressional delegation, a majority of the state legislature, to really think seriously about the future of our economy. And there are three major components to the business plan. One is a vision statement about where we want to go as a state. Then there's a strategic framework that spells out the broad areas that we need to work in to be successful. And then there's a set of initiatives that is essentially a to-do list that gets updated each year. And what the business plan has really served as for our state is a vehicle for pulling together all of the public discussion about our state's economy and the direction that we want to go in, and making sure that the public sector and private sector leadership of the state has a clear idea of what we're trying to accomplish and what we need to do to get there. And I'd like to think that after 4 years, it's done a pretty good job of institutionalizing a forum for addressing the economy in a very comprehensive way that leads to action.
A few years ago, you gave me a poster that was labeled The Silicon Forest Universe. Describe that poster and what it tells us about the fundamentals of economic development.
My colleague, Heike Meyer, did that. The poster as a result of her doctoral dissertation. And what she did was to essentially compile the biographies of all the high technology businesses in the Portland metropolitan area, the so-called Silicon Forest. And she identified more than 350 firms and traced the origins of those firms. And in Portland, we can trace the origin of a majority of all the high technology businesses in our community to two firms, a company called Tektronix, which started here in the 1940s, and Intel, which opened an operation here in the late 1970s. And what that poster shows is that the high technology activity that we have in Portland has really occurred as a result of sort of organic growth, that the people and ideas that were here decades ago through entrepreneurship, through people moving from firm to firm, have really fueled the growth of our local high-tech economy.
Is there anything that a city can do to encourage or discourage that kind of spin-off activity?
There certainly is, and I think that's ultimately the biggest source of opportunity for any city, is to look at the existing knowledge base that you have. What are the things that the people in your community know better than people anywhere else? In our studies of high-tech industry complexes around the country, one of the things that we observed was that the things that communities are good at today are in many cases a linear descendant of things that they were good at 2 and 3 and 4 decades ago. In Portland, we have a major center for companies that make electronic display devices of various kinds. They all trace their roots to work that a company building oscilloscopes did in the 1950s when it decided to make its own cathode ray tubes for its oscilloscopes. So if you're thinking about how to develop your economy, look at the kinds of knowledge and the talent that exists in your community and how you can extend that and apply it in other areas, because that's usually the biggest source of resilient growth in a community over time.
And that makes sense. But talk to me more in detail about how you actually encourage that kind of extension. In other words, what is it? Give me a couple of strategies that would work to encourage that kind of spinoff.
I think a lot of it has to do with the business culture of your community. Are you really open to new ideas, to entrepreneurship, to risk-taking? And frequently that means, are you open to people trying stuff and failing and giving people second chances? And one of the things that I think has been observed over time in the U.S. is that the communities that have been the most vibrant have been the ones that have been willing to encourage new ideas and occasionally tolerate failure, but really be open to people changing jobs and starting new endeavors on a regular basis. And if your community is a place that is reluctant to tolerate failures and is uncomfortable with the new and the different, then I think that's going to be the biggest single obstacle to this kind of growth.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's any way you could set out to encourage a shift in a business culture or a civic culture that, in fact, would give people second chances?
Yeah, I think part of it is really the stories that we tell about our economy and about our communities. And I think there's a real role for a variety of people in the media, people in public life, you know, just talking openly about many of these stories of entrepreneurship. There are very few entrepreneurs out there who have been uniformly successful in everything that they've done. And celebrating the, you know, the failures that you experienced along the way and on along the road to success is one of those things that I think we can do in our communities. But really describe economic growth not as something that was foreordained, but something that was the result of individuals and the decisions they made, the risks that they took, the trials that they endured.
You've also been working with a group of open source specialists in Portland to think about how to use open source to encourage innovation in a civic sense. Tell me about those conversations and the conclusions that you've reached.
Well, we've been talking to a group of folks who are involved in, as you say, the open source software community, people who develop the Linux programming language, and there's a real hub for that kind of activity in the Portland metropolitan area. And in talking to people in the software world, one of the things that we discovered was that they don't see a real clear demarcation line between the culture of coding software and the communities that they live and interact in. You know, a lot of the people who are software programmers by day are rock musicians by night. And the openness of a community to all kinds of collective innovation, of idea sharing, is not something that is confined to narrow commercial endeavors, but also applies to a variety of activity in the community. It applies to cultural life. It applies to civic life. So that's really what we're exploring with them, are the ways that we can sort of borrow from the learnings and from the model of collaboration and open software development to thinking about how we build civic participation and collective action to make our community better.
I think that's a fascinating discussion. Is there any sort of strand of that discussion, Joe, that particularly excites you?
At this point, you know, it's hard for me to say exactly where this is going to go. And I think that's, you know, one of the challenging and exciting things about this is that you sort of have to relax your expectations because you can't necessarily predict what way it's going to go. You have to be willing to trust in the process and the set of relationships that you're building. And I think that's one of the interesting sort of risk-taking characteristics of this is that since nobody has control over it, nobody dictates where it's going to go, everybody just sort of has to participate and be along for the ride and make their contribution.
Well, when you get further into the discussions, I hope you'll come back and share them with us.
Oh, absolutely.
Joe, it's always great talking with you. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure, Carol.
Joe Courtwright is author of The Young and Restless and A Knowledge Economy, a new report from CEOs for Cities. It's available at our website, smartcityradio.com. CityView's commentator Walker Smith says the impact young people are having on life in cities will alter all the old-timey stuff, including retirement.
The future isn't hard to predict. It sleeps in the upstairs bedroom. It is our children, the teenagers and 20-somethings who are one generation away from completely reinventing the world as we know it today. This is always true, of course, but there is something more at work nowadays than this obvious truth. Today's youth are not simply different. They will be different in ways beyond the historical experience of humankind. Technology is not just changing their experience of life, it is changing the very nature of life. This generation will be the first to grow up with the fruits of genomic medicine, cancer treatments that work at the genetic level to repair cells and keep mutations from spreading, nanorobots built from self-assembling strands of DNA or molecular positional assemblers that patrol the bloodstream to combat disease, even to rehabilitate faulty biology. Research from the Human Genome Project has found that only a few hundred genes are involved in aging. So-called cytosurgical nanorobots will be used one day to halt aging entirely by correcting these few genes in each of our 10 trillion tissue cells. It's not longer lifespans that await the next generation. It's the obsolescence of the very concept of a lifespan. And with it, things like retirement, annuities, and marriages until death do us part. Already, this generation sees that technology can be used to control and reinvent one's personal experience of life. Look at the technologies in which teenagers and 20-somethings are immersed. instant messaging, chat rooms, social networking websites, fan fiction websites, blogging, digital cameras, camera phones, photo editing software, file sharing networks, mashups, darknets, TiVo, NikeID.com, Google. It's all about individual control of an experience to make it into something that is personally unique. It's not about the freedom to choose. It's about the freedom to remake whatever is available into things completely different and often unintended by the originator. As journalist Gerald Maserati noted in 1998, the new digital culture has put an end to the so-called concept album. The plasticity of digital music means that listeners no longer have to listen to music the way the artist intended. They invent their own musical experiences, and it's true for culture at large as well. Even the silicon chips that have ushered in this self-inventive world are now easily programmable, so that any competent user, particularly teenagers and 20-somethings, can reprogram objects at will, like the toy robot dogs that college and high school students have reprogrammed to be feral robotic dogs able to sniff out toxic chemical contaminants. The real Mars and Venus are not men and women, but baby boomer parents and their echo boomer kids. This next generation of alien beings will be running the world in a decade. So watch out. These kids will be inventing a new and everlasting place for themselves, for which little in the past offers any precedence for the future. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City Broadcast, sign up for podcasts, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage, with additional music provided by Christopher Reyes. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and communities.